The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. I'm in my studio. Barry, you're in the same place that you've always seemed to be. I presume you move around your house on other parts of your day when you're not doing the podcast, unless you just sit there.
I just sit here all the time, and then twice a week flip open my laptop and press various buttons and plug things in, and that's it. So it's very exciting.
Now, a lot of people have been in touch and had been in touch even before lockdown to voice their displeasure at, and I don't know how often you listen back to the pod, the advert at the start where I say, I can't make the VAR chat stop. And people have noticed that the VAR chat has completely stopped. And David sent a great picture of me from about 15 years ago saying, can't make the VAR chat stop, and the coronavirus can make the VAR chat stop. So at some point we should do a VAR special, Baz, if you're in for it.
Well, I would say one of the main benefits, and there are several benefits to the current situation, without wanting to sound flippant, but, and certainly not having to talk about VAR decisions is one of them. I mean, people are going on about how much they miss football. I've said before, you know, I don't believe quite a few of the journalists who are going on about how much they miss football on Twitter. I think they're just letting on they miss it as much as they do, so people will take them seriously or whatever. I miss it a bit. I'm not bereft without it. But, you know, I don't miss bad games of football. I don't miss VAR conversations. I don't miss tedious Jose Mourinho controversies. So certainly that's a welcome benefit of what is an otherwise pretty bad time for a lot of people.
Hey, Barry,
mm-hmm.
Will you do the give us all your money emotional speech for this week?
I can do. I mean,
please.
Well, obviously, it's a difficult time and a lot of people are probably skint. So those people are exempt from this appeal. But anyone who does have a few quid to spare, we would be more than welcome to take it off their hands. We hope that you are enjoying Football Weekly as we continue to bring it, despite having very little football to talk about. I'm certainly enjoying doing it. It's nice. It gives the week a bit of structure, which is very pleasant. And I suspect you and producer Jonathan feel the same. But despite the fact that I think The Guardian is doing bigger numbers than ever before, people tuning in to get the latest updates on the coronavirus and reading in their leisure time, just catching up on stuff. Sponsorship is and advertising across the media industry has gone off a cliff. So, you know, we do need some money to keep going. And if anyone out there has a few quid and they're enjoying Football Weekly, we would invite them to make a little donation. Unfortunately, I don't have the pertinent link to hand, but if you want to provide that, Max.
TheGuardian.com/support. That's TheGuardian.com/support.
Was that sufficiently needy?
Do you know what? I thought it was needy, but it wasn't expectant. I think you got the tone really nice. And I suspect we will be we'll get more money than that nice army man doing laps of his garden.
Well, would it be wrong of me to say that I'm hugely unimpressed with his effort?
He's 99.
Well, you know.
But you think he should give it back?
Well, I just think, I mean, I could do something a lot more difficult and I wouldn't get 100 quid.
What are you
going to do? And he's probably fitter than I am. So while I applaud his effort, such as it is an effort, I do think that he's grifting the British public here. But all the money he's raising is going to a worthy cause, so hats off to him. You know, it just shows when you get the backing of Dan Walker, anything is possible. He's been touched by Dan Walker. And that's why everyone is, you know, I don't have a garden to walk up and down, but I could walk up and down my stairs 100 times. Do you think people would donate 10 million to me? No.
I think if lives had been very slightly different, I'd probably be Dan Walker. As it is, I'm sat in this tiny room looking at you complaining about a 99-year-old man raising £12 million for charity.
Is it up to 12 now?
Yeah.
Crikey. Well, it is very impressive.
Okay, coming up. Lars Sivertsen, the euphonium years, updates from Newcastle, the Premier League, the EFL, and of course, Barry's lyrics back in a sec. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Lars Sivertsen from euphoniums to the highs of being TV Norway's number one reporter to the lows of doing the pod with us. Welcome, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max. That's made me chuckle already, so that's a good start.
Okay. Are you excited about this deep dive into your life?
No, not at all. But no, I'm slightly sort of having... We've done this with Sid. We've done it with Philippe. I feel like this is like in terms of hinterland... My life story doesn't really match up, especially like after Philippe. It's not whenever I spend time with Philippe and he brings out an anecdote from one of his many, many past lives. It feels like there's so much there. And then I'm not sure there is. I might just sort of default to talking about the dog for 20 minutes here, but we'll see how we go.
If I was to give you any advice, I'd say even if your anecdotes aren't fascinating, if you do them with real conviction and you repeat them often enough...
Are you saying that's something that's worked for you?
I'm just saying. Especially if you've led an incredibly tedious life, yeah. I think it's a good idea. Okay, where did it all begin for you, Lars? What is your first memory of football?
Since I've been thinking about this a little bit, my sort of earliest memory of football is definitely watching my local team, Bryne, play at quite a poor level in what is objectively a quite poor stadium in Bryne. And I was watching, I think, late autumn or something. It was very, very cold and rainy. And I'm not entirely sure. I was very young. I probably didn't want to be there. And the most interesting thing was I think my mom had brought a very sort of hot sort of blackcurrant type drink in a thermos. And I was quite excited about that getting broken out. And what was going on the pitch. I think it was quite young, maybe too young to appreciate what was happening, but the warm blackcurrant stuff in the thermos I was excited about. That's very, very early. But then that gradually going every week grew into sort of realizing that what was going on the pitch was also quite interesting, I guess.
Now it's brandy in a hip flask.
Yeah, not supposed to tell people that, Matt.
So were you a Bryne ultra, Lars?
No, not really an ultra, no. But you know, Bryne was actually a very good club to grow up to in a lot of ways, because it was small enough that it felt local and that you had a local connection. But it was big enough a club, if you could use the word big here, that the football would be decent sometimes, and you'd watch players who could, you know, do fancy stuff with the balls, and there would be athletic achievements to some extent. So you'd watch it as a kid and you think this is very good. And of course there were a couple of seasons where we were in the top division, so we'd be on the evening news and this sort of thing, and you felt that very keenly. But at the same time, the players were like, they weren't millionaires, and you'd seen them walking down the street and you can say hello. And you had one player who came in and took some gym classes with us in elementary school and would sort of show us how to do overhead kicks on the big mattress and this sort of thing. There was one player who'd worked down the sports shops. If you bought new boots yourself, it might be the right back who was selling it to you. So you had that sort of actual connection with the team, but it was also good enough to get to a cup final and, you know, be on the TV. So I thought that was, for me, the perfect sort of middle ground of what a football club could be in a community. And I think that sort of connection is, I guess, something that you sometimes wish was more prominent in the modern game.
The Premier League, as we know, is huge in Norway. Like, we know that from, you know, doing live shows in Oslo and people actually coming. So did you have a Premier League team, or was the Premier League just on all the time when you were young?
Yeah, no, I'm gonna out myself since others have done so on the pod. I guess the phrase I use is that I grew up a Tottenham fan. And I think I still am. There is definitely an emotional attachment there, but I think it has waned a little bit over the years. And certainly working with this, you get so used to sort of switching off your reptile brain when it comes to football and just being a little bit more analytical. And I think after years and years of doing that, it's kind of harder to flick it back on again, I think. But I mean, I was very young at the time when they had Erik Tostvedt in goal. And he's from sort of Stavanger, so very close to where I grew up. And my father, when he played at sort of amateur level in Norway, he was a goalkeeper as well. And I was a young goalkeeper when I played. So it's very plausible. I don't know this for sure, but I suspect I was sort of plonked down in front of the TV when Tostvedt was on and sort of, this is our man, you know, this is our hero. And so I think that's how that ended up being a thing. And I have confronted him with it later, explaining that growing up in the 90s, being a Tottenham fan was maybe not as easy as it could have been if I'd sort of ended up supporting someone else. And yeah, he should take some responsibility for that misery.
I don't know if you remember, Lars, but Erik Tostvedt, his very first game for Spurs, I think it was, he had a mare, he threw one in, didn't he?
Yes, that was lamentable. But he was a very good goalkeeper. I think I'm right in saying probably our best ever goalkeeper in my country. I don't think I'll get too many angry protests from Norwegians on that one. I mean, he was very, very good. So I know it happens, but he was good.
So when you met him for the first time in a professional context, was that weird?
Everything's weird, Max, in terms of when you, because I went from sort of being, so I was writing articles for a sort of really good sort of independent football magazine called Yosimar, and doing a blog on the internet and stuff. And I sort of very quickly got sort of catapulted into a more sort of mainstream setting. So over the course of maybe 6 months, I met so many like who are people who are like big names in Norway and people who I've seen on the TV a lot and players I've looked up to suddenly I was in TV studios with. And it all became so weird that it was really hard to relate to and sort of really accept that this is a thing that's actually happening. And yeah, meeting him was really strange. And meeting Kjetil Rekdal for the first time was really strange. And being in a TV studio with Henning Berg was really strange. But you just get to the point where there's so much strange going on that you can't really, I don't understand that this is my career and that this is happening, but I'm just going to have to go with it because I can't just sort of shut down like a computer that's been given too much to deal with and just breaks. Because I think that's where what was very close to happening inside my head on a number of times, that you just kind of go with it.
There may be people out there who aren't aware, Max, but basically Lars was the Norwegian Jeff Shreves, wasn't he?
Well, I guess you could say that. I ended up in England as the sort of man who does interviews with players after games. And but I did a lot of things. I also did like interviewing fans on the streets before games. It's an interesting contrast doing interviews with fans before the game and then doing interviews with surly managers afterwards in a day's work. That's kind of fun. No, I've done a lot of stuff like this.
Did you have then like a big break moment?
Yeah, I think the moment where I sort of went from sort of getting the occasional byline in a magazine and sort of thinking I might be able to eke out a living from this, but it's going to be really hard to actually, you know, things looking up. I think there was the one sort of transfer deadline day, actually, where I believe the story was they were going to get Norwegian scout and international man of mystery, Tor Christian Carlsen, and then he couldn't make it. And they got me in instead to be like in a TV studio on transfer deadline day. And in hindsight, they must have been completely mad because they put me in to be on the sofa, to be on the broadcast for just hours and hours and hours. And they'd never met me at the time. Like that, I might have been a complete lunatic, you know, who could barely string a sentence together and, you know, would fall over himself in front of a microphone. They had no way of knowing that. But they sort of put me randomly on quite a lot of airtime. And that went okay. And then, yeah, I think that was kind of a starting point for a lot of things.
When you came over to the UK first, how were you received by your sort of colleagues, you know, UK colleagues? And because I didn't meet you you'd been here quite some number of years before I met you. And I'd heard stories about you. While I won't go into the details, in my head, oh, God, you were this mythical wild man of football journalism. And then I actually met you, and you really didn't live up to my expectations. I'm disappointed to say you were depressingly normal after some of the stories I'd heard.
Yeah, but like this is sort of you met me at a slightly different phase of my life because I was sort of catapulted in my sort of mid to late 20s. I was catapulted into a role where I think, let's be honest here, overpromoted, I think, is a word we have to use. There's not, in hindsight, there's no way around it. But yeah, I was suddenly put into this role of tremendous prominence and in a very small country, but still some prominence. And I went to all these games. Like I said, there was one season I went to like 83 games in the Premier League in one season. And so I was sort of here, there, and everywhere. And yeah, I think there was a lot that happened very quickly, and I'm not sure all situations were handled as well as they could have been by myself. So I mean, it's sort of some of the stories you may have heard might sound lamentable in hindsight, but you know, I don't know, when you give a young person a lot of attention and a lot of responsibility, very suddenly, not everything will go well. Whereas now I'm slightly older, so maybe I've settled down a bit, Baz.
I don't want to give away your, you know, your live show material, Lars, but you do put up a selection of photos of you next to, you know, Villas-Boas, Wenger, Mourinho, David Moyes, and they all look thoroughly uninterested.
Well, I mean, have you ever tried interviewing Jose Mourinho after he's not had a great game, maybe dropped some points, and you're like the eighth broadcaster he's speaking to? And you get like, you all get three questions, and pretty much everyone asks variations on the same three questions. You know, they don't want to be there, and I completely sympathize. I think that the challenge being like an international TV reporter is that you're not a natural part of the ecosystem, right? Because if these managers have a message they want to get across, which they often do, you often see them come down and they'll give pretty much word for word the same answer, like, because they have some points they really want to make. It's the whole media game that they play. You know, they'll say those things to Sky or to Match of the Day, or if it's a BT game, like to the host broadcaster. And the reporter then has some value to them because he's part of the ecosystem for communicating with the public and with the fans. When you're there from like Norwegian TV, you're not part of any ecosystem. Like, you're not necessary. They don't need to talk to you. It doesn't make a difference what they say. So there's no reason for them to be there. And they just feel like this is 3 minutes of my life. I'm not getting back. And then additionally, because we wanted to show like this is our man who's in England. So we did this sort of weird, when I said spoke to cameras, sort of standing next to the manager, like, here we are with Jose Mourinho. I'd say that in Norwegian to camera and then sort of turn to him. And that was always like the moment, I think, when they were next to this sort of scruffy looking young reporter who didn't even wear a suit or anything, who was speaking in a strange language to camera, and you're just standing there like an idiot. I think this is the moment where the sort of darkness started descending on a lot of these managers. And I guess there are some screenshots of, you can just see the darkness in their eyes.
Could you do in Norwegian, thanks, and you join me next to Jose Mourinho after a disappointing 3-0 defeat? Could you do that in Norwegian for me?
Well, it would also, I'll be a little bit nervous as well. So, oh yeah, her står med då med Jose Mourinho i intervjuer på Carrow Road, or the top the poäng mot the, I'm sorry, you lost some points against Norwich today, Jose. This was a bit bad. I mean, you can imagine this is not a setting where they're very happy. Like, I completely understand they want to get out of there. And like, having done this so many times, it's not just with managers, but also with players sometimes. I really sympathize with the idea that you have these young men who run and kick a ball for a living. They don't talk for a living, and they've just run around for 90 minutes. And what they want to do is sit down and relax and get out of there. And you have some dickhead in a blazer putting a microphone in their face saying, you need to say something really clever now, John Obi Mikel. It's like, it's really unfair to them, really. It's not an easy gig for them. So whenever you see those post-match interviews, if they seem a bit anemic on the part of the person being interviewed, you should have some sympathy with them, really.
Lars, you keep up with a ridiculous number of leagues. A genuine question from me is, how do you find the time? And a supplementary question, whether you consider yourself a specialist in any specific area.
But I think this was something that started at university. with my closest friend at the time. We were sort of pretty much every weekend. Like, he had a nicer student flat than me. A very nice student flat he had, where we both at the start of the semester got like a really comfy chair each, and he had a pretty decent TV, and they were in at his flat. And then sort of at the every weekend, I'd come over for like the early game from England, and we would watch football for the rest of the day. You know, we watched the early game. There's no 3 p.m. blackout in Norway, so we'd watch whatever was on then. And then you'd watch the later game, either from England, or if the game from Italy would be more interesting, maybe you go Italy. And then there'd always be one after that as well, whether it be from Italy or from Spain. And then sometimes there'd be, you know, some interesting MLS stuff going on later on, at which point you're sort of, you're quite late at night then. So you'd go through sort of 3, 4, possibly even 5 games on the Saturday, at which point, if there was a house party in his big student flat, then that football watching would seamlessly blend in to drinking and meeting people in the house parties. It was quite good. And then you'd repeat that pretty much on the Sunday, watching just everything that was on. And that was pretty much every weekend. So I got into this pattern of just watching almost everything that was on. And I've always found that the more I know about football, the more I enjoy watching it. You know, the more you know the context in terms of the history of the clubs and the various rivalries and the various players and all of this stuff, the more you know, the more you get out of it. And I have a lot of friends who are not football people and who don't watch football, and I've gotten the sort of classic line, you know, what's so interesting about 22 people running after a ball for an hour and a half? And I would say that, you know, if that is all you see, of course that's not very interesting, but if you know all the background to it, then there's, you know, Shakespearean drama unfolding before your eyes very often. And I guess part of the answer to the question why I watch a lot of different leagues is that there's so many good storylines and so many interesting things going on. If you open your eyes a little bit and look, just, you know, you don't have to watch Bournemouth Burnley. You know, there could be the Seville Derby could be on, and that's probably a lot more fun. Like, you open your eyes to new worlds and so many new interesting things.
Would it be fair to say, Lars, that you and your pal were stoned off your heads during these marathon football sessions?
No, that would be very unfair. Very drunk towards the end. I mean, we're never much for the herbals.
Okay.
But a fairly sensational amount of beer we were able to go through, I'd say. And he started dabbling with, like, brewing his own beer way before the whole sort of craft beer thing was a thing, and before people got quite good at that stuff. Some awful things were produced. But, yeah. No, there was more of the alcohol than the herbs, I'd say.
I had you down as, like, a Harold and Kumar, but into expected goals.
Well...
We've got some listener questions for you, Lars. Michael says, Lars is known for enjoying some statistics, even a little XG now and then. Has he done any statistical training?
I really haven't, and I've sometimes thought about doing it. I'm not a numbers person at all, and this might surprise you. I'm not a tidy sort of maths man who understands numbers. I'm terrible at maths in school, and I'm a very untidy person. I just acknowledge that there is truth in these numbers. You know, I don't always understand them, but I think there's a lot to be gleaned from them. So I don't really know my way around the spreadsheet. I don't know how to work these things, but I think there's a lot of there could be hidden truths there that we should learn, and I would just accept that this is going to be a bigger part of sport, no matter whether we like it or not. So it makes more sense to try to understand it than to just dismiss it as being nonsense, which some of it I guess is, but I've sort of always made an effort to, if there's stuff I don't understand, that doesn't mean it's not important. So I guess with the statistics, I just feel like that's something that's coming whether we like it or not. So it makes more sense to try to understand it a little bit better. But maybe actually going into doing a course on it would be interesting. A
couple of musical questions. I'll put them together. Jeremy says, does Lars have an ambition to play a tuba one day? Jim says, in brass instrument terms, if the trumpet is the Lionel Messi, gets all the solos and is poster boy for brass instruments, what football player is the euphonium? You were a euphonium player of some repute back in the day.
I was a euphonium player of no repute.
You toured the UK.
My sister is quite serious about it. She's been with the Stavanger Brass Band for many years. They're current Norwegian champions, and in 2018 finished third, I believe, in the European Championships. So they're quite serious about it, and she's very, very good. I'm not so. But I've played a little bit. I should stress, in a sort of traditional British brass band setup, there's no trumpet. It's all cornets, I think you'll find. So the trumpet is not even invited to the party. The euphonium is really sort of... it's a very tricky part in the arrangements. Usually, is you get a lot of solos, and it's technically very difficult. So it requires a lot of work. You can't slouch around as a euphonium player. So which football player would be like a euphonium? There would have to be, and there are quite a few girthy euphoniumists out there for some reason. There are very few, very small and spindly euphoniumists. So there's someone who has a bit of physical heft, but someone who's also technically very accomplished. So I'm not quite sure. Bit of a prima donna, probably. A very good euphoniumist can be a bit full of himself. Who springs to mind, Max? I need an assist here. Who do you think?
A cocky, stocky, but skillful player.
Yeah.
Okay.
Quite serious as well, though. Not like Antonio Cassano type, like someone who takes things a bit seriously.
I mean, I only have former Cambridge winger Shane Tudor, but I don't think that's going to...
Okay, let's go with that. That's fine. I'll trust you.
The barrel-chested Shane Tudor, who one of those wingers who never got to the byline.
I think Eric Cantona would have played the euphonium, probably.
Okay, fine. All right. You have Cantona, I'll have Tudor. Connor says, are Scandinavians more prone to picking up accents? I remember Thomas Sorensen and Peter Schmeichel picking up Northern Lilts. So, I mean, not to mention Jan Molby, of course.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I've never thought of it. I mean, we do. I think we all learn English pretty early, but that's often from like American TV. So I think you'll meet a lot of Scandinavians who have slight American twangs to their English because they watch a lot of American sitcoms and stuff growing up. Whether we pick it up quickly, I've no idea, to be honest. But there are a lot of terrific examples. One of my favorite ones is Harald Martin Brattbakk, a striker who played for Celtic, not very long at all. Who certainly, if you listen to interviews with him from a while back. He has a sort of slight sort of posh Glaswegian thing to him, which is quite remarkable because he wasn't there for very long at all. And he went on to become a commercial airline pilot, which is one of my sort of favorite sort of footballer post-retirement stories. You don't see many of them going into flying planes.
Ben says, as someone with a long dead and long unknown half Norwegian great half uncle, which Norwegian team should I arbitrarily start to follow, and which Norwegian national team shirt is the greatest?
So, I think a good pick for someone just sort of dabbling with Norwegian football. I mean, you should be a bit careful. It can be a gateway to more serious things, Norwegian football. But if you want to dabble a little bit, I think Brann from Bergen is a decent place to start for a number of reasons. Brann is a sort of, it's a big-ish club in Norwegian context. They're like the main team in the second biggest city. So you have scope for dreaming there and hoping you can win and stuff like this. But they're a team who are sort of notorious for being a bit of a basket case. Like a lot of weird things often happen there. There's one Twitter account from a fanzine-y type thing called "Is It Strange That We Drink?" It's a team that oscillates from glory to abject in the worst kind of abject comedy nonsense. And also, Bergen is a decent place to go for a weekend. You know, it's a lovely city in between the mountains. Weather can be a bit iffy, but in terms of just nature, it's a place I would advocate visiting. So have a look at Brann.
And the best year of the Norwegian shirt?
I'm not even sure about the aesthetics, but in my mind, so much of it comes back to World Cup 98. I think it's hard to get away from that. I mean, the win against Brazil is, I think, possibly the greatest moment in Norwegian sporting history, with apologies to all the skiers who objectively have achieved bigger things than beating Brazil in a group stage match. I think it mattered more than anything I can really remember. So I think visually that's the one that comes to me immediately.
What happened in it?
We beat Brazil 2-1. We were 1-0 down and then came back late with a goal from Tor-André Flo and then a penalty, which looked a bit dodgy at the time, but it turned out there was a big shirt pull in the area. So it was rightly given, and Kjetil Rekdal from the spot converted, and we managed to win. And the Norwegian, I should pitch this to Wilson for a piece for the Blizzard, just going through the Norwegian commentary for that game, because the commentators did really lose their minds. I mean, the expert commentator was... Lars Kjaernås, who was Egil Olsen's assistant at Wimbledon. So some serious pedigree there. And he just sort of lost the run of himself completely. When we went 2-1 up, he's sort of saying that we should just kick the ball into the Mediterranean for the rest of the game. Because the game was held in Marseille. And because the ref was American, he said something about buying hamburgers for the rest of his life. I mean, it was really one. People just lose their minds completely. It was really good.
Finally, Baz asks, Lars has to solve a brutal murder in a remote, desolate, yet hauntingly beautiful part of Scandinavia. Which regular pod member would be his complicated and abrasive partner, one with whom he forges a deep bond of trust and friendship through shared hardship and trauma?
I mean, there's only one answer to that question. It's Philippe. And you mentioned, I didn't answer that properly. How I was received by my colleagues coming over to England. I mean, Philippe has always, from the day I've met Philippe, he's been remarkably generous with his time and incredibly helpful in every way. So Philippe Auclair is a great man. And if I had to solve a murder, I mean, I absolutely couldn't solve a murder. But if I had Philippe at my side, you know, I feel like I could achieve most things.
Thanks, Lars. I enjoyed learning about your life. I feel like I like you even more than I did 20 minutes ago. Barry, do you share those feelings?
Yes. Yeah, that was very interesting.
Great. Sound like Baz said that with conviction as well. All right, that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with the possible new owners of Newcastle United. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start with Newcastle United then. A group of investors backed by Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund are close, apparently, to ending Mike Ashley's 13-year reign at the club. Documents revealed on Tuesday show that the group's leader, the financier Amanda Staveley, has laid down the legal framework with Ashley's company for a potential £300 million takeover. The breakdown of the ownership would be 80% Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, PIF, 10% Amanda Staveley's PCP Capital Partners, and 10% British property investors, the Rubin Brothers. Staveley's likely to be on the club's board, with the chairman expected to be Yasir Al-Rumayyan, a governor of the PIF. The consortium does not expect the Premier League owners and directors test to pose any problems, but Amnesty International's raised concern about Saudi Arabia's involvement. Amnesty claims PIF's move into English football is glamorising the kingdom's abysmal human rights record and accuses PIF of using Newcastle as a PR tool. Felix Jenkins is head of campaigns for Amnesty in the UK. He says, under the Mohammed bin Salman regime, Saudi human rights defenders have been subjected to a brutal crackdown with numerous peaceful activists jailed. There's been a blatant whitewash over Jamal Khashoggi's grisly murder, and the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen has a disgraceful record of launching indiscriminate attacks on homes and hospitals. To some degree, this is his quote, sports washing can be countered if interested parties are prepared to break its spell. We'd call on Newcastle United staff and fans to familiarise themselves with the dire human rights situation in Saudi Arabia and be prepared to speak out about it. Sources close to the new owners point to the consortium's diverse composition and suggest the Saudis' willingness to embrace outside involvement is indicative of a Gulf state demonstrating its desire to change and embrace 21st century modernity. Barry, thoughts?
If I was a Newcastle fan, I'd be delighted to see the back of Mike Ashley, but I would be depressed to see who looks likely to replace him. I've noticed on social media, which, you know, we have to stress isn't a particularly accurate barometer of which way the wind is blowing, that a lot of Newcastle fans are also uncomfortable, and many of them, the vast majority, I suspect, don't care. They just want Ashley out. They are hopeful that these new investors will bring with them loads of money. It's the way football is, you know. A lot of them are already engaged in whataboutery. And I think in this situation, whataboutery is okay. And they're going, what about Manchester City? What about boxing? What about Grand Prix racing? And they're saying, you know, no one made a fuss over those things, which is absurd, because a lot of fuss has been made over heavyweight boxing being staged in Gulf states, Grand Prix, and about the source of Manchester City's wealth. So to suggest that reporters are only getting stuck in because they have an anti-Newcastle agenda is ridiculous. And I've no problem with people trying to defend these new investors, but at least do it in a manner which isn't completely stupid.
I think this is a logical endpoint of football's long-standing problem with just really not caring at all where the money comes from. And this is not a new phenomenon. It's not even an England-specific phenomenon. It's certainly not a Newcastle-specific phenomenon. If you go through football history, there's so many examples of, I mean, you can go all the way back to sort of Colombian drug barons using football clubs there to launder their money. I mean, football as an industry has always had this problem with, just as long as you have money, we really don't care who you are and where you come from and what you represent. That has always been the way, many places anyway. There's some exceptions. And you can say this shouldn't... on the surface of it, there's just absolutely no way Saudi Arabia should be allowed to own a Premier League football club. There should be some sort of framework in place to stop that from happening. But the door has been ajar for so long, and Barry's right about the whataboutery there. And it becomes a sliding scale, and it's really difficult if you allow one thing to suddenly nix the other. But it's like, it's just so surreal now. They have to do this sort of fit and proper persons test where they look into sort of whether they've been convicted for fraud, and this is a problem. But whether you represent a state where they still have public beheadings, that isn't really part of the criteria for the fit and proper persons test. I mean, it's just bizarre. And I listen, Harry Redknapp once said that football fans and players don't care. You could have Saddam Hussein owning a club. If you put money on, they'll chant, "There's only one Saddam Hussein." And maybe he's right. Maybe people don't care. I wish people did care. But there's absolutely no reason why this should be allowed to happen, really, if you think about it morally. But I think it will be allowed to happen, and it's utterly depressing.
Can either of you see a time when this might change? I mean, I just can't see it ever changing necessarily.
But what I wonder, as we've established in this pod, I'm quite young. I wonder, you guys, was there ever a time where we weren't quite so addicted to money in the sport? Like in the mid-70s, if Idi Amin had tried to buy Luton Town, would people have gone like, "Oh, this is an exciting investment. I mean, we might see some better players at Luton. You know, might bring some joy to Luton. Who knows about Idi Amin? Maybe he has good intent." I mean, was this part of the discourse in the past? Or is it just now?
When I was growing up and taking an interest in football and reading Shoot magazine every week religiously, no one knew or cared really who owned football clubs. It just wasn't a thing. And it was mainly local businessmen, you know. So the fans who were going to games every week would have known who owned their club. But beyond that, no one cared. No one was interested. And, you know, a lot of these local businessmen may well have been very unscrupulous on a smaller scale. But, it wasn't an issue, a topic of conversation, really.
Well, I really sympathise with Newcastle fans who end up in a sort of moral quandary now, because obviously you've supported the club your entire life. Maybe your father and grandfather or mother and grandmother supported them their entire lives. You will have an emotional attachment that goes way beyond any sort of intellectual complaints you may have about what goes on. I mean, watching a player in black and white score a goal will trigger an emotional response for you, regardless of who owns the club. You can't change that. But at the same time, you know, okay, you might have more money to spend on players. That's an upside. But the downside is that the club is now owned by a place where, you know, homosexual, you can be punished for being homosexual. Women are discriminated against. You have this horrible kafala system where migrant laborers basically need their employer's permission to leave the country, which means that you can mistreat them however much you want. This is a dreadful place. And there is the public beheadings. I mean, this should be nowhere near English football, nowhere near. And this is now your club. And you can't, like, switch off your emotional attachment to that club, and no one should expect them to. It just puts you in a really awkward and difficult position.
Moving on, the English Football League, Professional Footballers Association have made a collective recommendation that players in Leagues 1 and 2 agree a wage deferral of up to 25% for April. The terms of the deal would mean no player would see his wage reduced below £2,500 a month, a figure equivalent to the maximum level of subsidy under the government's furlough scheme. A statement released jointly by both body said, in order to deal with the most immediate payroll issue, the EFL is recommending to clubs that local discussions are held with players in respect of the month of April only. Meanwhile, the Premier League, Nick Ames writing in the paper, a commitment to completing this season before the start of July is among options being considered by Premier League clubs. They're due to meet on Friday. A resolution to consign this season to history by the 30th of June, whether or not the entire schedule of games has been completed, will be among the proposals put to the league. Among one of the most significant parts of this is to finish by that point. It's the expiry of numerous player and staff contracts by the end of June. Premier League would require 14 club majority to approve any decision. Should it go through, the chance of completing the season would be very remote. Most teams have got 9 games to play. 4 of them have 10. So, Barry?
This is a wheeze that is motivated entirely by greed and fear that they're all going to lose out on a load of money. There's a very interesting article from Sports Illustrated doing the rounds at the moment, where they're basically saying, look, if you think there is going to be sport played in front of fans within a year, you are deluded. This PhD in epidemiology, Zach Binney, says, we will not have sports events with fans until we have a vaccine for the coronavirus. So people are now planning to play games behind closed doors. But the guys in Sports Illustrated make the point that, you know, if you want to do that, everyone who is going to be involved will have to do self-isolation for 2 weeks beforehand. They, you know, they all go to some place in the Midlands, say St. George's Park. No one can come in and out. Everyone has to be tested multiple times. That's not going to happen. All personnel will need to be tested daily. That's not going to happen. They'd need ambulances and paramedics who are obviously needed elsewhere more urgently. Any player who needs outside medical help would need to isolate for another 14 days. They're going to need transport. And if a single person involved in what they call this whole Jenga tower tests positive at any time, everyone has to self-isolate again for another 14 days. It's just totally impractical. And I honestly can't see the players being up for it either, because it's more or less they're getting sent to prison for a month or more.
Arsenal want their players to take a pay cut of 12.5%, which would apply if they did not qualify for the Champions League when football restarts. That suggestion has been rejected by a significant number of the squad. One agent with high-profile representation in the Arsenal first team said his position is simple. The solution has to be a deferral, and furthermore, one without caveats relating to the Champions League. Arsenal have a wage bill of about £230 million. Meanwhile, since our last pod, Spurs have reversed their decision to furlough non-playing staff. And acknowledged that pressure from supporters forced them to change their minds. And a statement from them, in view of supporter sentiment regarding the scheme, it is not our intention to make use of the current CJRS that runs until the end of May. The Tottenham Supporters Trust said it takes maturity and humility to reverse such a contentious and public decision. We're pleased that rather than doubling down, the club's board has listened to the fans on this occasion, ultimately done the right thing. Fitbar, Barry.
Well, Dundee have finally cast their vote, changed their minds and voted in favour of the SPFL sort of resolution and backed it. So anyway, it basically means that the Championship, League One and League Two in Scotland are now over. Dundee United, Raith Rovers and Cove Rangers have been crowned champions of those respective leagues. Partick Thistle and Stranraer have been relegated. Both feel very hard done by. Partick Thistle were sort of probably have a good reason to feel hard done by, because they were 2 points adrift from safety at the bottom of League One, the bottom of the Championship with a game in hand. Stranraer were sort of adrift, but they're kicking off because they're saying, look, there's still a third of the season to go. This is very unfair. So they're expecting the Premiership to follow suit, but they can't do that until near the end of the month because of a UEFA directive. Celtic will be crowned champions for the 9th year in a row. Hearts would be relegated because of the threats of legal action from various clubs who are going to be relegated. It's expected that, and I heard Ali McCoist say this on the radio this morning, he reckons it's a certainty that what they'll do is teams won't be relegated. They'll just restructure the league so they're bigger whenever football starts again, the next campaign starts. It's been handled incredibly badly by the Scottish Professional Football League, and they think they've done a great job altogether, but they've handled this so badly. I would steer anyone in the direction of Ewan Murray's piece in The Guardian to find out just what a mess they've made of everything. But they've made no apologies for it whatsoever.
Guy says, regarding Barney Ronay's unusual news sources, I found out that Osama bin Laden was dead via Phil Neville's Twitter feed in his at Fizzer days. I double-checked and Phil was indeed accurate. Happy to take more of them. Some reaction to Detective Wilson. This is Ipswich John. It says, with Detective Wilson surely due its TV adaptation any moment, is there a possibility of an Endeavour-style prequel with a young, misanthropic Wilson still solving crimes, but gives us the backstory on why goals are overrated and just what Frank Lampard did to wrong him? Listen, nothing is off the table at this stage. And to finish the pod with Barry's lyrics, of course, Paul says, I'm repeating myself for Baz to recite the lyrics of Scatman or Freak Me by Another Level. I went to look at Freak Me by Another Level, Barry, and I found it quite smutty, if I'm honest. So I went for Scatman. Paul did say, with his sexy baritone voice, doesn't everything Baz say sound a little smutty, especially when you assume he's not wearing trousers?
Oh, God.
So on that note, we leave you with Scatman by Scatman John. Lars, thanks for coming.
Anytime.
We'll speak to you again soon, no doubt. Barry, do you have the lyrics to Scatman to hand?
Of course, I'd never leave home without them. Not that I've left home.
So you always
You never know when they're going to come in handy.
Here we go, everybody. It divides the nation, but here is Barry reading.
Well, I don't think it does, Max. I think just producer Jonathan hates it. everyone else is quite ambivalent.
So it's right at the end of the pod, so you can turn it off if you don't like it.
Here we are, causing complete indifference around the nation and around the world. It's Barry Glendening.
Skibby dibby dib, yo da dub dub, yo da dub dub. Skibby dibby dib, yo da dub dub, yo da dub dub. I'm the scat man. Skibby dibby dib, yo da dub dub, yo da dub dub. Skibby dibby dib, yo da dub dub, yo da dub dub. Bada bada ba bebop bop bada boop, bop ba 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 boop, bebop ba bada boop, bop ba bada, bada 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 bop ba bada boop. Bop ba bada boop, bebop ba ba bada boop, bop ba bada boop. Everybody stutters one way or the other, so check out my message to you. As a matter of fact, I don't let nothing hold you back. If the scat man can do it, so can you. Everybody's saying that the scat man stutters, but doesn't even stutter when he sings. But what you don't know, I'm going to tell you right now, that the stutter and the scat is the same thing. Yo, I'm the scat man. Where's the scat man?
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.